This episode of Promised Land uses audio clips that contain language and subject matter that are graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I've never lied to you. Your Bible is full of lies. Your sky God makes no sense. If he was all perfect, why don't he come down and do something? If he can heal everybody in a minute, why doesn't he heal them all? Why did he make all these different races to fight and to kill? Why did he bring some into the world born blind? America, 1973. Christian America. Jehovah's America. Bible America, 1973. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain by following me. Why don't you deny yourself? Why don't you deny yourself? Why don't you say yes to this cause and no to that slave system? I thank you. I thank you. I thank you because my words are spirit and my words are life. This is a revolution that will heal you. This is a father that will save you. This is one that will shepherd you through every storm.
In 1972, life in the slums, known as the Watts in Los Angeles, was a very hard place to live in. There were many issues, such as lack of jobs for the African American community, as well as violence, drugs, and alcohol. It was almost impossible to raise a family with no opportunities to grow. The elderly also had hard times as they were living off their Social Security checks in these neighborhoods, barely surviving. The streets were extremely unsafe for people, and most were scared to leave their homes. Jones, with his mindset in expanding People's Temple, found this location perfect for his mission. He knew that the lack of trust in the local government and law enforcement would play into his favor. In the summer of 1972, People's Temple purchased a church and adjacent apartment complex at 1336 South Alvarado Street. Here he would offer services for local members to listen to his preaching, as well as have nurses available to check their health, social workers to help with any issues they may have, and legal advice for those with family members that may be in trouble, as well as for themselves. They even offered drug rehabilitation for those in need by taking them into their facility in Redwood Valley. People's Temple also offered transportation for those who wanted to attend services. There were pickup locations for people to get rides from the Greyhound buses, so they were able to attend the temple services without any worries about having to walk in the bad parts of their neighborhoods. Jones knew that these people would be devoted to the temple, as no other churches offered to help clean up the lives of people as well as spread the word of God in racial equality. Even with the new church in Los Angeles, Jones wanted to stretch his reach further and obtain a permanent location in San Francisco. San Francisco at this time wanted to appeal to tourism and viewed their lower income neighborhoods as an eyesore. The government wanted to wipe out these neighborhoods from the map because it didn't fit into their narrative for a beautiful city. Jones saw a chance in this as the community needed to come together and have the means to fight back to save their homes.
I did not mean to preach so long. I've already talked ourselves out of an offering. The enemy is upon us, come in like a flood anyway. We need our help more than we ever needed it before, because he come in the very moment he came when he saw us spread to Los Angeles. He didn't like this big building being in the hands of the body of Christ. Didn't like that at all. Didn't want the apostolic church to get over here on Hoosier and Alvarado. How do I know it? Because some people told me so. That they're going to stop you. They want to keep you up there in the hills of Redwood Valley. They don't want you to come down to Los Angeles. I said, that's a very, very way to get me down here more often. So, I'll be back 2 weeks from this Saturday. And you keep fooling with me, and I'm going to be back here every weekend because you cannot keep me out.
People's Temple eventually purchased a multi-story building at 1859 Gary Boulevard in San Francisco. This building needed some costly repairs, so while the repairs were underway, Jones continued to preach at the local high school as he had for the previous years. People's Temple needed to gain loyal members at this location, so Jones used an old tactic of poaching members from local churches, but he did this in a more subtle way. He offered free banquets at every service, he proclaimed his amazing abilities, and how many benefits there are to being a member of the People's Temple. Local ministers noticed that they were losing all members rapidly and were in an uproar. One minister went to a local newspaper that was well known in the lower class neighborhoods called the Sun Reporter. They wanted a story written about the People's Temple and how they were stealing all of their members. But to their dismay, they learned that the lead reporter was also a member of the People's Temple and would refuse to write an article badmouthing the temple. This reporter was a local physician whom Lynetta Jones was a patient. She would talk of her son and the great things he could accomplish, and the physician realized he and her son had many things in common, so he went to his service and soon became a member of the temple. Jones would divide his time on the weekends between the Los Angeles church and the San Francisco church, then spend weekdays in Redwood Valley. Though Jones's time was now divided among three cities, he made sure to spend quality time with his members back in Redwood Valley. They would often enjoy picnics out in the church parking lot after services, where he would greet and spend time with members. One picnic, in the summer of 1972, is one that would not be forgotten for the members of the People's Temple. As Jones was making his rounds talking to members, gunshots rang out to break up the happy festivities. People panicked when they saw Jones on the ground, with blood starting to soak through his yellow button-down shirt. Marceline and Jack Beam quickly assisted Jones to his feet and led him to his home across the street, where they disappeared inside. Members waited and worried, thinking their pastor had died from this shooting. After 30 minutes, members were told that evening services were still happening and that they should enter the church in preparation for the service. Everyone, still grief-stricken, waited for what they assumed would be an announcement that their pastor had died, only to be amazed when Jim Jones walked up to the pulpit seemingly unharmed. Jack Beam held up the yellow shirt Jones was wearing, brandishing the gunshot holes and bloodstains, stating that Jones had healed himself. No gunshot wounds were found on Jones when he showed the members his chest, just a small indentation where he claimed to have healed his own wounds. This made all his members even more faithful to him and his amazing powers. Jones really used this incident to ramp up security by now having the excuse to give his guards rifles instead of handguns.
There's a great love here. They're not going to tell this story. No, they're not. But I'll tell you, the tide's against them. They may bring us down, down, seemingly in natural circumstances, as they did Jesus so many days ago when they hung him on the tree and he seemed to be a loser and laid away in a tomb. But my followers got me out of the tomb there, and they'll always get me out of the tomb. I shall always come out. You can't keep me in a tomb. You can't keep the Christ idea, the revolutionary idea of socialism. You can't keep it in a tomb. You just nail it to the tree, and it'll come off the tree. You tried to nail me with a few guns not long ago, shot me down before all this congregation. My people screamed in such agony, and I don't want to ever hear that agony again. They screamed as I fell on the floor, blood gushing out of the holes in my chest. But I said, I'm not ready. My time hadn't come. You weren't organized yet enough. You weren't the little gods that I want you to be, because I'm daddy god and you're my baby gods, and I want you to be just like me. And I rose on that floor and I said, I'm not ready. And they put the nurses put their finger through the three holes. They're here just like a kind of a triangle, put their fingers in them. And they couldn't, they said, well, you can't continue. We get a finger in there to swab out the mucus and blood. You must go to a doctor. I said, I'm the doctor and I'm the lawyer and I'm all I need. So if we did it once, we can do it again. And if you're not careful and you're dilatory and careless, then they will take me and do with me what they will. But my name will get known, and you won't be able to separate yourself from me, because I'll be on every TV and on every radio and on every newspaper, and you won't be able to say I never knew him, because every time you wake up, I'll be haunting you, because they'll be talking more about me than they've ever talked about anybody. When I get through, they're going to be talking about me.
this wasn't the only assault that would fall onto Jim Jones in 1972. A reporter from the Indianapolis Star wanted to keep tabs on Jim Jones after the article was released about him raising the dead. She soon discovered that he set up a church in San Francisco and decided to write the Examiner asking for any updates they may have on Jones, and sent them the Indianapolis Star article. The Examiner forwarded this letter to one of their journalists named Lester Kinsolving. This intrigued Kinsolving enough to contact the Ukiah Daily Journal, the local newspaper that Jones had control over, to see what info they had to share on this self-proclaimed healer. He was shocked that not long after contacting the Ukiah Daily Journal, he started receiving numerous letters praising Reverend Jim Jones and all his good deeds. He later found out that an editor of the Ukiah Daily Journal had contacted People's Temple and gave them the heads up that a San Francisco newspaper was digging for information on Jim Jones. This didn't stop Kinsolving's thirst to learn more about the People's Temple. He and a photographer drove up to Redwood Valley to attend one of the services there. Though the photographer was not allowed inside, Kinsolving was able to sit through this service. He had noticed the tight security at the entrance of the church and that the guards were armed with rifles. He also attended a second service in San Francisco, where Jones had already knew he was among the congregation. So he put on a grand show for the reporter by bringing two people back from the dead during his service. One member who was healed during this service had called out that Jones was God, and he quickly came back and said, quote, "What do you mean by that? If you believe that I am the Son of God and that I am filled with love, I can accept that. I won't knock what works for you, but I don't want to be interpreted as the creator of the universe. If you say he is God, some people will think you are nuts. They can't relate. I'm glad that you were healed, but I'm really only a messenger of God. I have a paranormal ability in healing." Tim Stone had written a letter to Kinsolving asking him to please not publish anything about Jim Jones or the People's Temple, and this ended up doing more harm than good. His letter did nothing to stop Kinsolving in releasing the first of a series of 8 articles. On Sunday, September 17, 1972, The Prophet Who Raises the Dead was released. In the article, it stated, quote, "One director of the temple claims that the prophet has returned to life. Jim has been the means by which 40 persons have literally been brought back from the dead this year. When I first came to the church, I was the conventional skeptic about such things. But I must be honest, I have seen Jim revive people as stiff as a board, tongues hanging out, eyes set, skin graying, and all vital signs absent. Don't ask me how it happens, it just does. Jim will go up to such a person and say something like, I love you, or I need you, and immediately the vital signs reappear. He feels such a person can feel in his subconscious even after dying. Jim is very humbler about his gift and does not preach it." This was all in the letter written by Tim Stone trying to sway Kinsolving from writing his article. His article also spoke of the number of members, the income of the temple, the claimed harassment the temple was under by locals, the buildings the temple owned in Redwood Valley as well as San Francisco, the armed guards outside of the temple buildings, the sale of merchandise such as photographs or lockets with Reverend Jim Jones's image, and Stone claiming that Jones only wears hand-me-down clothing and rescues abandoned animals. After reading the article, temple members found flaws in the facts Kinsolving reported on. Most people would go down to the Examiner office and demand that the article be removed, but Jim Jones panicked. He knew this was the first in a series of 8 articles to be released daily, and he decided to wait for the second article to be released to decide what to do. The next article was titled, Healing Prophet Hailed as a God at San Francisco Revival. In this article, Kinsolving brings up the woman who was healed and called Jones God in San Francisco, with a quote from Jones stating, quote, "You'll have to understand, she was given up to die. They said she'd never be able to move again. Such experiences are not at all uncommon to us. That's the 43rd time this has happened. I just said, I love you. God loves you. Come back to us. The registered nurses around her said it so." He mentions the armed guards in Redwood Valley, mentions Tim Stone by name, and states he is the assistant district attorney for Mendocino County, and also one of the main advisors in the People's Temple. And about Marceline, quote, a trim blonde with Jones's adopted black son, a handsome boy of 14, singing the song My Black Baby while Jim Jones Jr. stood by her side. Jones decided to take action after the second article was published. He gathered all Temple members, including their children, and headed down to San Francisco to stand in front of the Examiner's building to protest with signs saying such things as, quote, "This paper has lied." Kinsolving even came down to personally greet the protesters, but had no intentions of canceling the rest of his articles.
But just the week before, I said we'd had enough. That's when the change came. It was just the week before. If he'd come 2 weeks before, he might have had a chance. But I said, I've turned the last cheek of my butt, and there's no more cheeks. I've wore out of cheeks. I said, the next one that bothers us, they better be prepared for a fight. So what happened? We marched ourselves down here to the Hearst Press, the great big capitalist press, the rich man's press, and I mean poor little old people, us poor little old people, black and brown and poor white. We got our placards and we marched around Jericho's walls, and I said, I'm going to meditate that their papers will burn and 240,000 of their newspapers burned down right inside the building. And we marched. I had them down there 98. I had them down there 100. I had them down there in their 80s and 90s, and we didn't stop marching till those editors come down and said, when are you going to stop? We said, we're going to stop when you quit lying on us.
That day, the third installment was released, titled District Attorney Aide Officiates for Minor Bride. This article simply stated that Tim Stone married a young teen named Mildred Johnson to a Temple member identified as Junius, and questioned if Stone had the right certifications to be able to marry anyone. The fourth article was titled Probe Asked of People's Temple. This article was by far the weakest of the articles, mainly discussing a former Ukiah First Baptist pastor asking the district attorney and sheriff to look into any misconduct in the People's Temple and their potential part in a local woman's suicide named Maxine Hopp. Jones, continuing his protests outside of the Examiner, was given a meeting with the editor and senior staff, with Kinsolving not in attendance. The editor decided to cancel the remaining installments in the series of 8 articles. The remaining installments were extremely accusatory and not based on hard facts. Some statements in the articles claimed that the Temple stole from Maxine Hopp's estate. An interview with Whitey Freestone, who was by this time a Temple defector, and pastors speaking of how Jones had stolen their members. Lastly, claims of Jones teaching students in a local night school class about how to masturbate and supposed, quote, survival training. The unpublished articles were titled The People's Temple and Maxine Hopp, The Reincarnation of Jesus Christ in Ukiah, Jim Jones Defames a Black Pastor, and Sex, Socialism, and Child Torture with Reverend Jim Jones.
In the course of the conversation on the air between Art Finley and Reverend Lester Kinsolving recently, Kinsolving, without any warning or prompting whatever, proceeded to attack and malign Reverend Jim Jones and the People's Temple Disciples of Christ of Ukiah, California. Kinsolving said, Reverend Jones has people believing he raises people from the dead. Said it would be nice if someone would go up and exorcise him. Stated that upon visiting this church, he had worn his collar, that he had been seized, that he had his photographer grabbed, and that he was himself interrogated by the assistant district attorney. And stated that his home had been burglarized for the first time in 8 years, 3 days after the Examiner was picketed by 150 people put there by the church. We of People's Temple assert that these statements by Kinsolving are untrue, malicious, and outrageous. Thirdly, we of People's Temple assert the following, that Kinsolving visited our church on at least 2 occasions and was allowed in to take notes each time. That there are many witnesses to the fact that Kinsolving did not wear his collar, that Kinsolving was not seized by us, that a member of the church, who happens to be an assistant district attorney, offered to show Kinsolving around the children's home, the senior citizen homes, and other projects of the church, and that Kinsolving said he was not interested, that the assistant DA did not, in any sense of the word, interrogate Kinsolving. Nor was Kinsolving's photographer in any way grabbed, and that we know these charges are patently absurd. We of People's Temple ask, if Kinsolving was so threatened, why did he come back the following week by himself? People's Temple also says that on two Sundays only, and after acts of violence had taken place against the church, and pursuant to the advice of law enforcement officials, did two members of the church in open view wear firearms, but neither even met Kinsolving, that they served as security in the same way as does any special policeman at any public function.
Jones had decided to counter any negative light shown in the People's Temple by releasing a series of newspaper articles speaking on all the positive aspects of the temple. Many of these articles were written under the letterhead of Reverend John V. Moore, Carolyn Layton's father. Upon seeing these letterheads, Kinsolving reached out to Reverend Moore for an interview. Moore was very angry when he found out his letterheads were used without his permission, but granted the interview anyways. The interview did not last long, as Kinsolving asked questions Moore did not want to answer, so he ended the interview short. After Kinsolving left, Moore realized that he had left his briefcase at his home. Moore spoke to his daughters before returning the briefcase to Kinsolving, and they asked him and their mother to come to the temple to discuss the matter before returning the briefcase. The Moores agreed to come, but left the briefcase at home, expecting their daughters to ask to view the contents, which they did immediately. Moore stated, quote, "They kept pleading and pleading, and then all at once stopped. My wife and I went home, and I sent the briefcase back to the reporter. Only later did we learn that while we were kept occupied at the temple, someone, I suspect our daughter Annie, went to the house and copied everything that was in the briefcase. So after that, Jim Jones knew exactly who Kinsolving had been talking to and what facts he had or didn't have about the People's Temple." After reviewing the contents of the briefcase, Jones was certain that Kinsolving had nothing and would not be able to write any other articles on the People's Temple. But to take extra precautions, he created a new branch in the temple named Diversions and named Terry Buford as the head of the department. The Diversions department was set up to create negative light on anything they could find out about other preachers and forward the information along to news stations and newspapers. Jones once bragged in a planning commission meeting that the Diversions team was so good at finding scandals that he could destroy anyone he wanted to. Terry Buford stated, quote, "He made it sound like we were terrorists or something, that no one was safe from us if we wanted to get them. It got so that lots of people on the planning commission were afraid of me. They thought if they even did the slightest thing that Jim didn't like, Diversions might come after them next." The Examiner articles actually ended up bringing in a lot of new and prominent members to the People's Temple, rather than exposing them. Tim Carter was a white Vietnam veteran who had read the Examiner articles and was intrigued by Jim Jones and the People's Temple. In January 1973, he and his sister Terry decided to attend one of the church services. As was common for new potential white members, they were sent to a small room to be interviewed so members could determine if they really wanted to be there or if they were CIA spies. After Carter told the interviewers his life story of his war experiences and early difficulties in life, they were allowed to sit in for a sermon. Carter was instantly memorized by Jones's sermon and felt he was almost speaking to him. He was so enthralled in the service that when the collections basket was handed around, he gave the last money he had in his pockets. He later said, quote, "I whispered over to Terry, I hope you've got the money for cigarettes because I've just given my last 68 cents. After collections was over, Jones pointed to where Carter was sitting on the balcony and said, quote, "You gave your last 68 cents, and that means more than the people who can afford to give $100. Carter was amazed and felt like Jones was able to read his mind. He later said, quote, "I thought, this guy has a psychic ability. What I didn't realize was that there was a guy planted in the row right behind Terry and me. He wrote what I had said on a card and passed it to somebody who passed it to Jones. By the time that meeting was over, I felt that I'd come home." Carter joined the People's Temple along with his sister Terry and brother Mike. He was put in charge of organizing the temple bus trips and found out that he was great with organization skills and excelled. Another prominent member was Michael Prokes. He was a newscaster in Modesto, California, and after reading the Examiner article, he decided to investigate People's Temple for his own news article. After meeting with Jones and other temple members, he was amazed at their political aspects, and he too joined the temple, becoming the official temple spokesperson to stand in Jones's place when he didn't have time to make statements. The last member to bring up at this time, Maria Katsaris, was a timid woman in her early 20s when she heard of the People's Temple from a fellow teacher she worked with. She joined the temple immediately and was put to work in the letters office. Her devotion to the temple and Jim Jones was unquestionable. Everything about the People's Temple was flourishing at this time. Membership was skyrocketing, money was flowing in, the amphetamines kept Jones on his toes, keeping him lively for his sermons, and temple social services were doing amazing work for people. Things were going so well that Jones's ego was at a high. But on January 7th, 1973, things took a different turn and would change things for the temple that Jones at the time would not realize. During one of Jones's sermons, one of the elderly members had fainted. It wasn't one of his planned healings that Jones was known to conduct. Marceline, as a nurse, rushed to the woman's aid and called for an ambulance. Medical personnel came inside the temple and gathered up the woman and started escorting her to the ambulance that waited outside. Concerned members of the temple had followed them outside where two armed guards were present. When one of the guards told the medical personnel to not put the woman in the ambulance, the man called for police backup, feeling intimidated by the two armed men along with a crowd of temple members surrounding them. After police arrived, the two security guards were arrested. Jones announced that everyone should head back inside and finish the service without him, and he joined the two men and police to head down to the police station. It's unclear how the situation actually played out, but Jones recounted to his members that he was tossed in a cell with the other two temple men, who police believed were the worst kind of thugs the city to have, and won over all the other inmates that were being held. He said he refused to leave the police station until his men and all other inmates were released. No matter what ended up actually taking place, Jones and his two temple members were released, but not without the police labeling Jim Jones as an antagonist and someone to watch carefully. Though not known to Jones at this time, this would not play well in his favor. One small step in the wrong direction, and the LAPD would be waiting. He would later learn how much of a mistake it was to now be on the radar of the LAPD.
Took away Brother Jackson, another government worker, never been arrested before. Brother Brown, never been arrested before. My wife, in all of her years, never been arrested before. And they took him to jail, and I went down to get them. And the moment I got there, they arrested me. They put me in handcuffs and sent me back there and says, we'll see what we can do with you people. Put me in the jail and they put the handcuffs on me and then put a thing on my leg and chained me to the bar. They must have believed I was a little bit God. I said, now what are you going to do about that? I said, I don't know what you're going to do about it, but I'm going to go to sleep. I laid down, they fixed it all up too. They had blood on the cell, you know, they'd just beaten some poor person. They thought they'd scare me, that blood. I laid right down the middle of it, put my arm under my head. I got me about 5 seconds of sleep, I guess. I guess it wasn't much longer than that, because when they back comes somebody and says, I heard him say this. He said, We got some kind of fool in here. This one officer said, I abridge you of your rights. I said, I know my rights. He said, you can get out if you've never been arrested on your own recognizance. I said, oh, no. I said, black and Indian people never get out on their own. They always have to bail. I said, even though I've got the means to get out and the wherewithal, and I have a name, and I've been a government leader, I'm not coming out. I said, I'm waiting on my trial. Well, I said, you damn fool, that will be 6 weeks. Says, we'll have to keep you 6 weeks. I said, that's your problem. I'm going to sleep. Now, that's almost exactly what I said. But it wasn't long. He brought back somebody else, and he said, you mean you're staying in here? He said, we've had many people who wanted to get out, but we've never had anybody want to stay in. I said, I'm staying in until every one of my people are free. I said, I'm going to be not let go on my recognizance. I'm not going to be bailed out of here. I'm staying here. You've arrested me wrongly, and I'm going to stay here until I have a trial before the people. And I said, if that costs Los Angeles $1 million, I don't care, because I said, it'll be a long, long trial. Now, I want you to know, they had my brother Jackson, he's standing back there, and Brother Brown, they had him on assault and battery, and with a deadly weapon, and, oh, I don't know what all they had him. Inciting a riot, everything in the world. We practically done it, and breaking a policeman's nose, and no one intended to, but he got in front of that door when I wanted my sister out of that ambulance. And by the way, the other miracle, they had her locked up in the ambulance, and then after the fight was over, they looked in the ambulance with the door shut, and she was gone. You never saw policemen so red-faced in all your life, because there wasn't a black one amongst them. They were all white. They were all white in that police force. But they were red-faced. Here they had a man that was supposed to have a gun. The gun was gone. They had a woman. They didn't even know what they were fighting over, because I had her. She was gone. The officer said, "Will you tell me one thing? Where did that old woman go?" All I said to him, I said, "That old woman is younger than she looks. She's a fast runner." I just played with him, and so a little bit later, back comes the head of the police. He said, "Now, Reverend, you know we've had a mistake here." I said, "Yes, you have." I said, "I want us all these charges dropped." Oh, he said, "Couldn't do that." I said, "That I want them all dropped." And what happened? They all got dropped, and they let us all go. And my name's not even on the record. They didn't even arrest me. They didn't even get my fingerprints. They put me in chains. They were so scared of me. They put me in chains before they got my fingerprints.
Promised Land is a Cool Down Media podcast. All audio clips for Promised Land come from the Jonestown Institute. For more information, visit their website at jonestown.sdsu.edu. Follow us on social media at Promised Land Cast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.